From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Ceasefires don't count for much in Syria. Just check today's headlines. Grabbing territory is what matters at the cost of mass murder of children, women, and men. The Syrians and the Russians, the rebels, the Iranians, the Turks, the Kurds, and the U.S. are all there. And until it's clear who controls which part of the country, the killing will not stop. This hour on Point, the carve-up of Syria and the civilians in the crossfire. You can join us on air or online. Can you believe what you are seeing? Barrel bombs in the Damascus suburbs. Chemical gas attacks. Do you feel helpless watching the Syrian people die? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first this hour with the latest is Liz Sly. She is Beirut bureau chief in neighboring Lebanon for The Washington Post. Liz, thanks for being with me.
Hello.
So we'll start off here with the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley. Here she is on Saturday as the U.N. unanimously ordered a 30-day ceasefire in Syria.
The United States wants nothing more than to see the ceasefire in this resolution implemented immediately across the country. It is critical that the Assad regime and its allies comply with our demand to stop the assault on Eastern Ghouta and immediately allow food and medicine to reach everyone who needs it.
So, Liz Sly, what is the status of that ceasefire?
Well, this ceasefire basically has not gone into effect at all. It never happened. It was dead on arrival. It was fatally flawed to begin with because it contained, it said it should be implemented without delay. It didn't say when. It didn't give an hour. There wasn't any negotiation between the parties to agree on a specific hour, and there were no mechanisms for implementing it. So everybody has just blithely ignored it.
And so Russia, then, in the last couple of days, has brokered another deal, which was another pause, a short truce then, I guess, a five-hour pause that was supposed to happen today. But even that has been broken with reports of shelling through the corridor designated for civilians to get out. Is that right, Liz?
That's right. The Russians declared that there would be a five-hour halt in the fighting today to allow food and medicine to go in, people to come out, as you said. There was some shelling during that time. Nobody came in, nobody came out, nothing went in because there were no mechanisms. There's no security guarantees. The people inside don't know what would happen to them if they came out. There aren't the arrangements on the checkpoints for the food to go in. And meanwhile, the fighting has started up again.
Here's some sound from Reuters from Eastern Ghouta outside Damascus. First come the sounds of airstrikes, then children screaming and desperate calls for help. So, Liz Sly, new ground attacks and aerial bombings have killed hundreds of people just in the last week. Tell us about conditions on the ground now.
Conditions on the ground are truly nightmarish. The head of the UN called it a hell on earth. You've got about 350,000 people living in this area. Most of them live in fairly flimsy homes. Some of them have apartment buildings that have basements. Others have dug holes underground. They've not been coming up for hours on end, for days on end, because the shelling is so intense. And in one of the sadder things we've seen, people have stopped taking injured people to the hospital because the risk of getting killed by the people who are taking them there is so high that family members have deemed it's better to leave a family member untreated than to risk the lives of other family members taking the injured to the hospital.
I saw pictures published online over the weekend by Syrian activists showing patients, including women and children, apparently suffering symptoms consistent with a chlorine gas attack. What can you tell us about that, Liz Sly?
Yes, it does look as though there was another chlorine gas attack on Sunday. This is not terribly unusual. The previous one was on February 1st, but we hadn't had one since the ceasefire negotiations began. And chlorine doesn't kill as many people as the bombs, but it is prohibited under international law to use chlorine as a weapon. And it sows a lot of panic because this was the site of the sarin gas attack in 2013 that killed over 1,400 people. And it sort of shows, you know, the U.S. has made the chlorine gas attack the particular focus of its efforts to halt the violence. And it kind of shows that there's a bit of defiance of the international community going on there by using the gas on the first day of the ceasefire.
Yesterday on Al Jazeera, a medic in eastern Ghouta outside Damascus was here. Here he is holding a dead child in his arms, talking about the chemical attacks there.
Today we have more than 30 dead, dozens of bombardments, and launching of chemical weapons. They bombard us with chlorine, sarin, and other gases from Iran. We don't know what they are. Assad, Russia, and Khamenei don't care about UN Council decisions. They still bombard us and use chemical weapons against us.
Liz, who's responsible for that attack? Is it the Assad regime? Is it the Russians? Do we know?
Well, it's only the Assad government that has the ability to deliver those kind of weapons. The weapons are arriving from outside and hitting the area. I know there's a lot of allegations that the rebels are firing chlorine at themselves, but the UN has done a lot of investigations, and they've always pointed back at the Assad regime.
The UN reported today that North Korea has actually been shipping supplies to the Syrian government that could be used in the production of these chemical weapons.
Yes, that is correct. I mean, you don't need North Korea to ship you supplies of chlorine. It's commercially available. But I know there are a lot of concerns in the U.S. that the Syrian government is developing other kinds of weapons that we could yet, chemical weapons, that we could yet see being used.
So earlier this month, the United States was engaged in airstrikes in Syria. Is the United States still engaged actively with boots on the ground in Syria at this moment?
Yes, it is. It has 2,000 troops in eastern Syria. They are supporting and advising a much larger army of allies made up of Kurdish and Arab forces. Those are still fighting the Islamic State in one tiny pocket of the country. It's a very small battle that's going on now in over a small area, but it has been quite fierce, and ISIS is sort of fiercely defending its very last little pocket in the desert in eastern Syria. But what we've also seen is those troops with their allies coming into conflict with the Syrian regime and the Russians in eastern Syria, and the Syrians and the Russians have repeatedly said they want the U.S. to leave now that the ISIS war is almost over. The U.S. says it's still fighting ISIS there. And it also says it will stay beyond the fight against ISIS to stabilize Syria, get a peace settlement, and also push back against the growing influence of Iran. So that's at the moment, it's been confined to some fairly contained battles, but it is something that we could see escalate at some point.
I know you have to go, Liz Sly, but several listeners from our website want to know about reports of Syrian civilians in metal cages being used as human shields on the outskirts of Damascus. What can you tell us about that, if anything?
That was an incident that occurred a few years ago in what appeared to be a very desperate attempt by rebels then to deter shelling and bombardments by the regime onto the area. It's been under siege for 4 to 5 years now. It backfired badly. It was a very, very bad public relations ploy. And those pictures are being reminded now to remind, being revived now to remind people that the rebels who are in the area aren't great guys either.
Liz Sly, Beirut Bureau Chief for The Washington Post, giving us the latest on the situation in Syria. Liz, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Joining me now from Washington is Ambassador Frederick Hoff. He is a special advisor on Syria. He was a special advisor on Syria for Secretary of State John Kerry and advisor to Special Envoy George Mitchell on Arab-Israeli peace issues. He is director of the Hariri Center at the Atlantic Council. Fred, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Jane, hello. It's great to be with you.
One of the bloodiest weeks in this 7-year civil war in Syria. What do you see in this new round of violence in Syria?
I see a continuation of a nearly 7-year policy of mass homicide on the part of the Assad regime. This is its strategy of choice, trying to survive politically. It attacks civilians in an effort to separate those civilians from armed groups that oppose the regime.
President Obama famously talked about a red line in Syria. Is the Syrian government now testing President Trump? Do we need a new red line at this point?
Yes, indeed. It is testing President Trump through the weaponization of chlorine gas, as Liz Sly mentioned. I have no doubt, Jane, that if sarin gas, the deadly nerve agent, were being employed by the Assad regime now, the United States would be exacting a military price of the regime. as it did in April 2017, when U.S. cruise missiles hit a Syrian airbase after a regime sarin attack and destroyed nearly 20% of the Syrian Air Force in the process. But Bashar al-Assad seems to be calculating now, as he did in 2013 after the Red Line crisis, as long as I don't use sarin gas, I can use anything, literally anything, against civilians.
So when you hear a UN Security Council unanimously voting to approve a resolution for a ceasefire to deliver aid and evacuate the wounded and civilians, and that ceasefire is roundly ignored, what does that tell you, Fred Hoff?
Well, it tells me that the resolution itself, though well-intended, is, as Liz Sly mentioned, severely compromised by a lack of an enforcement clause and by a major loophole that authorizes continued military operations against terrorist groups defined by the United Nations as terrorist. This gives the Russians, the Assad regime, and their Iranian backers the ability to say, look, there are bad people down there mixed in these 400,000 souls in eastern Ghouta, so we will just pound the place.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and punderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. That sound courtesy of Reuters, sound of overwhelmed civilians in East Ghouta outside Damascus, Syria. We're talking about the war in Syria, a ceasefire that is not, and civilians that are caught in the middle. You can join the conversation. Do you think the U.S. has the right policy in Syria? What more should we be doing, if anything, to stop the massacre of civilians? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Here was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking to the UN Human Rights Council yesterday, calling for an immediate halt to the fighting.
Eastern Ghouta cannot wait. It's high time to stop this hell on earth. We must speak up for human rights in an impartial way without double standards. And we must invest in human rights and recognize them as values and goods unto themselves, and not allow human rights to be instrumentalized as a political tool.
My guest this hour, Fred Hoff, former special advisor on Syria and now director of the Hariri Center of the Atlantic Council. I want to bring one more voice into the conversation now. And Noah Bonzi joins me from New York City. He is senior analyst on Syria for the International Crisis Group. And he just recently was back from a trip to the U.S. Kurdish-held northeast sector of Syria. Noah, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Jen. Thanks for having me.
So there you hear the UN Secretary General talking about hell on earth in Syria. What do you see in the escalation of fighting there and the ignoring of the call for the UN ceasefire?
Well, it's certainly a sign of the extent to which events in Syria have gone well beyond what a UN Security Council can accomplish or rein in. And I think the fact that you saw just within 24 hours of the resolution passing an escalation of the pro-regime offensive, the alleged use of chlorine as a weapon, and the fact that, as Liz accurately pointed out, really very little has changed since the resolution calling for the ceasefire was released, is indicative of how the pro-regime camp in particular is waging this war and of the limited options that other components of the international community have to deal with it.
Mm. So 7 years into this war in Syria, hundreds of thousands of people killed, millions forced from their homes. Remind us what kind of war this is. Is it a civil war? Is it a proxy war? Who are the players of most importance here?
Well, you know, we'd almost need a two-hour session to really cover just what's happened in the last month. But to just give some sense of how complicated things have gotten, arguably this war is more complex than at any point over the last 7 years. Just over the course of the last month or so, you have Turkish forces conducting a major operation in northwest Syria against in the area of Afrin, against Kurdish forces who are allied in northeast Syria, but not really in northwest Syria, with the United States. So obviously that's something we could talk about for some time. Mm-hmm. Simultaneously, you have in the northeast, as Liz said, about 2,000 U.S. troops on the ground. You have now a small but increasing number of civilians who are helping Kurdish and Arab forces fight against ISIS, but also to stabilize territory captured from the group. And the U.S. is also there to sort of provide a security umbrella to prevent new escalation in that part of the country. Meanwhile, in the northwest, you had just a few weeks ago, it looked as if the regime and its allies were going to launch a major offensive against rebels and jihadists remaining there. That was narrowly averted basically because Turkey deployed some observers along a de-escalation line, a sort of ceasefire line negotiated with Russia. But what the pro-regime camp then did, the regime and its allies did then did, is take some of the forces that were going to be involved in that offensive and have plowed them into this major and horrific attack that we're now seeing in eastern Ghouta.
Fred Hoff, jump back in here and help us understand the different players, Iran, Turkey, the Saudis, ISIS, other terrorist groups, all nested in Syria, Russia, of course, right there in the middle of it. What is Russia's role here to your mind? Is Russia sort of the puppeteer behind the curtain in Syria at this point?
Yeah, we have, as Noah indicates, we have a fine kettle of fish in Syria. I think what Russian President Vladimir Putin has wanted out of Syria more than anything else is his ability to turn to the Russian electorate, his constituents back home, and say, look, I've been able to save Bashar al-Assad, of all people, from an alleged American regime change campaign through the region. Pay no attention to corruption in Russia. Pay no attention to a failing economy. Pay no attention to a kleptocracy. This is Exhibit A of Russia's return to the world stage as a great power. So for Russia, this whole exercise, military intervention that began in late September 2015, has been, at least from the point of view of Vladimir Putin, an unqualified success.
Yesterday, Britain's deputy UN ambassador Jonathan Allen blasted Russia's call for a 5-hour delay, daily pause in the fighting in eastern Ghouta. Allen told reporters at the UN headquarters that all council members, including Russia, are obliged to implement the 30-day ceasefire in Syria completely and, quote, without delay.
That is not compliance, that is not implementation of the resolution passed on Saturday, but it does show that it can be implemented. So Russia can implement it if it chooses to. If it's able to do a 5-hour pause, it's able to do a 24-hour pause. So it's up to Russia whether it wants to implement fully the resolution that it signed up to and voted for, or whether it wants to play cynical games.
Noah Bansi, cynical games. You hear that there. What about the report that Vladimir Putin himself called for a temporary ceasefire in Syria? How do you see all this?
Well, I think it's very difficult for us outside the Kremlin, frankly, to judge exactly what's going on in the Russian leadership's thinking. But from everything we can see thus far, those making the decisions in Moscow have decided to lend full weight behind this pro-regime offensive in eastern Ghouta. Now, they have not necessarily done that in every case where they could have in Syria. As I mentioned, an offensive was delayed for now in the northwest. But the Russians seem to basically be helping the regime manage its military costs and risks. They don't want to take on too many difficult battles simultaneously. So they're focusing what at this point are actually pretty limited regime resources. I mean, you have a government that is quite dependent on relatively narrow section of reliable manpower, of Syrian manpower, and also very dependent on foreign fighters supplied by Iran and others. I think there's a lot going on with Russia right now. I mean, I didn't mention but could have. Along the Euphrates River in eastern Syria earlier this month, you had a major and somewhat mysterious incident in which a bunch of pro-regime fighters crossed over the Euphrates River, which is the line that divides sort of the U.S. sphere of influence from the Russian sphere of influence in eastern Syria. Pro-regime fighters, including many Russian mercenaries, crossed the river. U.S. forces who were on the ground there alongside some of their local allies fired upon them, killed reportedly hundreds or at least 100 of the attacking forces. Russia has downplayed this incident, but it's indicative of just how much, just how tricky things are and the risks for escalation that are throughout the country and can emerge in unexpected ways.
Let me get Omar in here from Savannah, Georgia. Omar, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hello. Thanks for taking the call. I'd just like to make a few points. First, I don't think this could be considered a civil war, given there are so many outside players involved, including the two powers and Turkey. And secondly, I don't think the United States is going to do anything, given its proclivity to going along right now with everything that Putin is advocating. And Putin, let's not forget, is Soviet through and through. And I think what they're trying to establish is a foothold back in the Middle East, similar to when they were in Egypt. So, I have no illusions. I think this is just wholesale slaughter with the poor Syrians caught in the middle.
Omar, thank you very much. Fred Hoff, jump back in here. Omar mentions Turkey. What about Turkey? They've made some threatening noise in the middle of all this. Where do you see them landing?
Yeah, at this point, Turkey's principal interest, I think, is to prevent the creation of a Kurdish autonomous zone along the length of the border between Turkey and Syria. Turkey's position is that Kurdish political life in Syria is dominated by an organization that is basically the Syrian branch of the terrorist PKK, which from time to time has been in a state of insurrection against Turkey inside Turkey. President Erdogan of Turkey is certainly not a fan of President Bashar al-Assad of Syria. Erdogan invested the better part of a decade in trying to build up a strong relationship with Assad and felt completely betrayed by the way Assad reacted violently, as he did, to peaceful demonstrations at the beginning of this uprise back in 2011. But again, Turkey's main focus these days is on Kurds.
So, Noah Bonsi, it sounds like different parties, all these different entities, are carving up Syria, taking a different piece for themselves. Is that an accurate representation of sort of what's happening in Syria right now?
I think it's fair to say that there's, to some extent, a scramble for resources, for territory, for influence, and to shore up core priorities, both by the Syrian actors themselves and by those outside the conflict. But there's also, some of the potential for escalation extends really beyond just the control of territory. I mean, also, we haven't mentioned yet Israel in this conversation earlier this month. In another somewhat complex incident, you had an alleged Iranian drone crossing into Israeli airspace. Israel responded with airstrikes hitting where they say the drone came from. One of an Israeli plane was downed. That led Israel to further escalate strikes on both regime and Iranian targets. Israel has certain red lines it's trying to lay down, trying to diminish a permanent Iranian presence to the extent possible inside Syria. So, in a way, this, because there's no single actor in this conflict that is capable of completely imposing its objectives or completely achieving its objectives or imposing its preferred end state on everybody else, there's a lot of dangerous back and forth.
Here's Sarah in Akron, Ohio. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thank you. Hi, Jane.
Hello. Go ahead.
Jane, what I'm going to say comes with a lot of passion because I am Syrian and I have family in Syria. And I just want to say that I find it very disappointing that we are all sitting here relying on governments that are not going to do anything. And on the United Nations, who is not going to do anything? I think right now it's up to the people of the world to unite and spread awareness, because it's very, very disappointed to see all these Syrian people being massacred daily, and no one is speaking about it. The media is silent about it.
Well, here we are today talking about it. Sarah, have you been able to speak with your family? Do you know how they are doing in Syria?
Yes. I speak to my family. They're fine. I mean, they had a bombshell fall on their house yesterday, and thank God it did not explode.
Sarah, thank you very much for the call. Fred Hoff, you hear the emotion.
Yes.
There. We cannot forget the human toll in all this.
The human toll is the most important part of all of this. Look, the slaughter of civilians has real security implications for Americans, whether they know it or not, whether they really want to focus on it or not. This brutality has been, and really will continue to be, a recruiting tool for Islamist extremists all over the world. American friends and allies in the region have been flooded with refugees. And in fact, in 2015, there was a refugee tsunami across Western Europe, one that roiled the politics of our European allies to the delight of the Kremlin. We're dealing with the premier humanitarian abomination of the 21st century to date, something that has cost the American taxpayers billions of dollars. And the Assad regime in particular has set an example of largely unpunished mass murder that may well be imitated by others in the Middle East and beyond. Chemical warfare, whether it's been sarin or chlorine, has been part of this campaign. Another bad example for bad actors around the world.
Sarah, thank you very much for your call. Let's get Brian in here from Dresden, Maine. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call, Jane.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say I was really frustrated with the lack of presence that the United States has in this war. I wanted to compare it to Vietnam and the Korea War, and even our presence in Iraq, which was over regime change and oil, probably. What exactly is the reason for the lack of presence by the United States military? I know that we're doing some aerial work there, but as far as I've heard on the news, we just don't seem to be caring too much as far as our military and government goes. I just wanted to point that out.
Brian, thank you. No, I appreciate it. Noah Bonsi, we are coming up on a break here, but speak for a moment about the U.S. involvement. There were airstrikes the beginning of February. Brian wants to know why not more.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the U.S. policy options in Syria were never good and they were never easy, and they've gotten steadily worse and harder as the war has gone on. The U.S. actually is playing a bigger role on the ground and in the air than they have at any point, but it's contained primarily. Well, yes, there's the red line about sarin use that the Trump administration is signaling that it's going to enforce. But for the most part, the U.S. role is in northeastern and eastern Syria in support of counter-ISIS efforts. And also, we should emphasize, in support of what the U.S. calls stabilization, some very light reconstruction and rehabilitation, but light but significant, enabling life to return to these areas that have been liberated from ISIS. The U.S. role is basically on those two fronts and in trying to contain the conflict to keep escalation from moving into the areas where the U.S. has a presence. It can do that at an acceptable price. Anything more would require a real shift in policy.
Fred Hoff, just about 10 seconds before we have to scoot to a break here. There was that American attack on the convoy earlier this month. What do you see the U.S. doing moving forward?
I see the east of the Euphrates River, I see the U.S. priority be, to stabilize areas that have been liberated from ISIS. West of the Euphrates River in Syria, the main question is going to revolve around civilian protection. A red line for sarin only is interpreted by Assad as a green light for everything else.
Fred Hoff, former special advisor on Syria, now director of the Hariri Center at the Atlantic Council. Really appreciate your time, Fred. Thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure, Jane.
Thank you. Noah, stick with us. When we come back, we'll speak to a Syrian doctor about the plight of innocent people trapped inside Syria. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Before we get back to the show, we'd like to ask you about you. That's right. We want to learn more about our listeners with a short survey. It's anonymous and easy. Just go to wbur.org/survey to complete the survey right now. That's wbur.org/survey. This survey will be tremendously helpful to us. So thanks.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. Those are sounds from Ghouta, outside the Damascus suburb, courtesy of the Syrian American Medical Society. We have been talking about Syria this hour, getting our heads around why the war in Syria will not stop. And now, what does it mean for civilians? You can join the conversation. Do you think the U.S. does need to do more or stay out? Syrian Americans, we want to hear from you. Yesterday, in a report from CBS News, foreign correspondent Charlie Daggett asked this mother of 8 and 10-year-old girls if she had seen any change since the ceasefire.
The war planes target us again.
So there were more airstrikes.
Yeah, and bombs. More than 20 bombs.
More airstrikes, more bombs. Since the ceasefire. With me this hour, Noah Bonzi, senior analyst on Syria for the International Crisis Group. And joining me now from Dubai is Dr. Jad Salam. He is Syrian and board member of the International Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations. It's a nonprofit with 2,000 doctors and volunteers working across Syria right now. Dr. Salam, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Hi, Jane. Hi.
Hello. Thank you. You have volunteers in Syria and especially in Ghouta right now. What are they saying about the situation on the ground? It's been particularly devastating there.
Exactly. I'm just in contact now as we speak, and I just received two messages from our director, Usam International, in Ghouta. He just told me that the death toll for today is 16 civilian killed, and one hospital has been targeted. It was quiet till 1 p.m. Damascus time, and suddenly airstrikes started and nonstop, more than 40 airstrikes so far till the present as we speak now. So the situation is dreadful. I can say that the death toll for the last 8 days is more than 600 civilians since the ceasefire announcement by the Security Council. Mm-hmm. More than 50 civilians has been killed, and there is 2,100 civilians injured in the last 8 days. Mm. So, and the mayor of Eastern Ghouta just launched a declaration denouncing the attitude of Russia, allowing only 5 hours a day to allow people to walk out, and he is inviting all international organizations, WHO, UN, everybody, to send convoys, please, to Ghouta. He is asking why this didn't start yet after 48 hours of implementing the Security Council resolution. Mm-hmm. So immediately, our doctors are capable to treat those 2,100 injured people, but they need immediately towards the Ghouta to enter those convoys with humanitarian aid, medication, and food. People are dying from starvation. Yesterday, a baby died, a 45-year-old baby died because he had no milk. And this is a daily tragedy happening.
So tell me more about that. Tell me more about life for civilians in these government-held areas. Where do people get food, basic staples?
Well, there is many charities are buying from the black market 10 times priced food, which people cannot afford. You can imagine somebody whose income $50 a month, how can they pay for $4 a kilo of sugar in a family with 10 members? So they cannot afford anything. So there is many charities which is offering thousands of meals every day. Like there is a Red Crescent offering 20,000 meals a day. So people are being paid food, paid by international funding from charity work. Nothing is arriving from the UN. Nothing is arriving from inside Damascus. For the last 5 months, there was only 43 caravans arriving to Nesheviya. 43 caravans are hardly enough for 7,000 people, right, which is Nesheviya for a few days. Ghouta has 400,000 inhabitants, and they have nothing arriving in a regular basis.
And so are hospitals functioning, Dr. Salam? Are they under fire? Are they being targeted? Where are people being treated?
Well, there was 23 hospitals targeted the last 8 days. Some of those hospitals were targeted five times. So our colleagues, there's more than 100 doctors inside and more than 600 of medical personnel. And our organization and some big other organizations are trying to help to rebuild those facilities. But at the moment, they are using parking places, improvised operating rooms to deal with those injured people, to offer them what they can, using non-sterile to sterilize sutures, which is not acceptable. Yeah. So it's the situation is devastating.
Let me get a call in here from Savannah, Georgia. Hi, David. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you very much.
Yes. Go ahead.
I mean, we're all heartbroken by everything we're hearing. Wonder where is it going to stop? Wouldn't this be classified as war crimes to some extent? Where does it? I mean, I'm almost afraid after this that then they're going to the Kurds are going to try to eliminate the Kurds.
David, thank you. Noah Bansi, what about David's question? Why isn't this considered to be a war crime? These horrific events in Syria.
It is a war crime. It reminds me of Srebrenica, where 8,000 civilians were killed in 1995, and that finally triggered a reaction from the international community. It is a massacre. It is a crime against humanity. Chlorine has been used four times this year, three times against Douma, with 21 civilians suffering in a borough full of civilians. That is somehow trying to push civilians away from Ghouta. It's a kind of modern ethnic cleansing. And now it's we can call it ideological cleansing, with state terrorism being exercised against those civilians who has been, by the way, living for 5 years in freedom, in dignity, obviously with no electricity, nothing to survive. But we have heard from our colleagues that they have a full system of election, democratic election in the local council. They have judiciary system. There is educational high commissioner, which, by the way, is liaising with the Damascus educational commissioner to do exams for students. There are more than 125,000 kids in Ghouta, and they had, till recently, quite good level of education in a war zone under the ground. And like in Erbin, there is 74 shelters under the ground. So they are bound to their shelters, no ventilation, no electricity, but they are learning and there is teachers. And
life goes on to some extent underground. Yes, I hear you. Noah Bansi, jump back in here. You hear what Dr. Salem is saying and our caller David wondering about war crimes. I mean, Ghouta has been the scene of mass homicide, to say the least. I mean, what's next? I'm looking at a map of Syria here. Is the next move now to Idlib in Syria? Where do we go from here?
Yeah, unfortunately, we've gotten to the point, or long since past the point in Syria, where the fact that these are war crimes is really making any difference in terms of how the actors on the ground, in this case, we're talking primarily about the Syrian regime and its backers, Iran and Russia, in the case of Eastern Ghouta, how the fact that these are war crimes is not influencing their decision making. And, you know, given the way broader changes in the international community, kind of the era we're in of a receding U.S. role in the region, Russia, which is a permanent member of the UN Security Council and could be taking steps to really rein in these tactics, is instead not only enabling those tactics but participating in those tactics. There aren't clear vehicles to address this. And unfortunately, what we've seen is that the strategy that is being employed by pro-regime forces, which Fred accurately described, is built on collective punishment, the intentional targeting of civilian neighborhoods and infrastructure, including hospitals, is a major part of the pro-regime camp strategy of that by the regime, by Iran and by Russia. They keep using it because it's achieving their objectives at manageable cost to them. And so long as that's the case, and I mean, it is painful to say these words. I know it's painful for people to listen to them. But as long as that's the case, we're going to continue to see these tactics applied in Ghouta, tragically, as they've been applied elsewhere. And as the war continues, if it stays on this trajectory, they will be applied in additional places. Idlib is one candidate, very sadly. we've been having these conversations for 7 years, and really you do run out of things to say.
Here's Bill in Warren, Michigan. Hi, Bill. I'm glad you called. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. I'd just like to kind of put things in historical perspective. The U.S. should not be bombing people in Syria and then accepting them as refugees. During World War II, we bombed German civilians because we were at war with them, but did not accept them as refugees. Here we are bombing people and then accepting them as refugees. We are either at war with them or we are friends with them. Which is it? It makes no sense.
Bill, thank you. Noah Bonsi, well, what do you say to that? Bit of a different situation, but I guess the larger point, what is our interest in Syria as we move forward and to the caller's point?
Well, in terms of U.S. interest, I mean, this has always been such a controversial topic. And, you know, of course, the Obama administration made a series of decisions when it was running Syria policy that were really based on the assumption that the U.S. interests in Syria were minimal. I think I would tend to agree with Fred's point that what we've seen is that, in fact, the international ramifications of what's happening in Syria have had serious impact on direct U.S. interests. I think to a large extent, and I'm sympathetic to how difficult these decisions are for U.S. policymakers. I mean, just take the U.S. experience in Iraq and the lessons we try and derive from that. On the one hand, one lesson I think that many American policymakers derive from Iraq is that when you stay too long on the ground in a place, it can become a quagmire. You might be attacked by Al-Qaeda-linked or now ISIS-linked jihadists. You might be attacked, as happened also in Iraq, by Iran-backed insurgents. So the U.S. has 2,000 forces on the ground. Of course, policymakers are worried about what might happen to them there. But another lesson from Iraq is that if you withdraw too quickly when you already have a presence on the ground, you can leave a vacuum behind. You can leave vicious cycles behind that, as we saw following the 2011 U.S. withdrawal from Iraq, can be exploited by jihadis and end up leading to even worse impact on U.S. interests as well as for people living in these areas. These are excruciating decisions.
Herman is in Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Herman. Welcome to the program.
Jane.
Hi.
Pleased to meet you.
Thank you.
I'm wondering who's supplying the weapons to the rebels in East Ghouta for their what is probably a last-stand battle, and which in the process is endangering so many civilians. That's my question.
Herman, thanks. I'll ask Noah Bonsi. Do we know who's supplying the rebels? Is it Russia? Is it North Korea? Who is it?
Well, at this point, the rebels were talking about Denis and Ghouta. There were earlier points in this conflict where some of them were receiving, we believe, support from Saudi Arabia, and from another portion of them were at least at some point receiving support from a collection of countries that included the United States. But that's in really previous phases of the conflict. In recent months, the siege has tightened so much there, and the international support has really ended. Both what Saudi may have been providing, what the U.S. and other countries were providing. At this point, they're basically using what they already had stashed and what they buy on the black market. At least that's how I understand it.
And Jim here in Kent, Ohio, is asking, who are the rebels? Who are these rebels that we keep referring to? Is it ISIS? Is it Al-Qaeda? Who exactly? How would you identify them?
It really depends on where we're speaking in the country. But in Eastern Ghouta in particular, we're talking about a range of almost entirely local forces. The biggest two are Islamist groups, which are not really considered, which we do not consider international jihadists. They're not directly linked with Al-Qaeda or with ISIS. They are conservative, but not part of any international agenda. However, there is a very small contingent of forces who are members in what used to be an Al-Qaeda affiliate. This gets very complicated, but that's we're talking maybe about 200 or so of those jihadists in a rebel force of thousands. The other rebels have offered to push those jihadists out to negotiate their withdrawal to another part of Syria. The Russians in the past had expressed some interest in that kind of deal, but don't seem to be interested in it right now. But that's just in Eastern Ghouta. Elsewhere, the balance of power within among opponents of the regime differs dramatically.
A lot of listeners have comments. One from our website, Syria is a mess. Russia plays both sides with both Syria and North Korea, and with the decimation of our State Department, U.S. does not have a coherent policy to address this evil. Another says Assad's war on Syrian civilians and citizens is mass murder. It shows no signs of stopping. It's time to get the players to the table to negotiate an end to this carnage or take Assad down. Noah Bonsi, what about that? Any signs of parties coming to the table? Gosh, we've got a whole plate of people engaged and involved in this, with a UN ceasefire being ignored. I mean, what are the chances of that?
Well, the Syrian regime itself has never shown any interest in seriously negotiating. The hope has always been that its backers, and in particular Russia seems to be the most likely candidate here, that Russia would eventually see that the regime is not capable of accomplishing all of its military objectives of completely restoring control throughout the country, that its forces are depleted, and that Russia would pursue some sort of compromise through a UN-led political process. That's sort of been the optimistic working assumption of U.S. policy and the policy of many Western countries. Unfortunately, it's still not clear that Russia really sees that kind of negotiation towards a political process that really involves regime opponents. It's not clear that Russia actually sees that as necessary. And I think there are probably divisions within the Russian system on that issue.
An important conversation to have this hour. Noah Bonsi, senior analyst on Syria for the International Crisis Group. We're grateful for your time. Great explanations on a complicated situation. Noah, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Jad Salem is a board member of the International Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations. Dr. Salem, thank you, and good luck to your doctors, to your teams in Syria. Best of luck. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jane.
Continue the conversation, listeners. Get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about two big Supreme Court cases, one about the future of unions, the other about data privacy overseas. Until then, I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.